Good morning. We'll bring this meeting of Ohio State Affairs to order. It is 8:15, and we have Representative Gardner, Representative Lynn, Representative Ramos, Representative Gruenberg, Representative Seaton in attendance. Today we have two items. The first one is House Bill 383, which we've heard, and we'll have our first hearing on Senate Bill 86, State and Municipal Liability for Attorney Fee. So we have HB 383, Motor Vehicle Transactions before us, and sponsors here. We also have an amendment that the committee had asked for last time on designation of bank and credit union and sales contract. And we want to look at that. So Representative Guerra, would you introduce yourself for the record? Go ahead and give us any other additional information. And you might even want to bring us up to speed quickly again on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it.
We'll take a brief at ease because we have the dumpster truck out the door, so we'll wait. And Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll keep this brief just to remind people what this bill does. It was about 2 weeks ago we were here. It has two sections. One is a section that says for car dealers, when they sell a car, the price that they offer has to be the price that they charge you. They can't say the price plus fees because a lot of car dealers add on what's a $200, $300, what they call a dock fee. And we don't mind them charging what they want to charge, but they have to insert that into the price that they tell people they're going to charge. There was a question about language in the bill on that one. We said that the price they offer to a consumer, either in an advertisement or when they're negotiating, has to be the advertised or negotiated price. And there was a question from the committee, does negotiated price have to be better defined? And Ed Sniffen, who runs the unfair trade practices section at the Attorney General's office, is online. He can explain his letter to us, which was that he feels that we don't need to define that any further. He feels it will be clear. So that's question number one. The other question has to do with the other part of the bill, which was the practice of some car dealers. A lot of them are not doing this anymore, which is good. But some car dealers imply to a consumer that the bank loan that they're offering is at the interest rate that the bank is charging. And so it'll say First National Bank, 4% or 5% loan, when in fact First National Bank is only charging 3.5% or 4%, and the dealer is keeping 1% or 1.5%. The dealer can keep whatever they want, but in our bill we say if they're going to keep some of it, and they're going to imply that this is a bank loan with the bank interest rate, if they're going to keep some, they just have to inform the consumer that they're keeping some. They don't have to say how much because that might be hard to calculate. They just have to alert the consumer. And the consumer can then do what you do in a free marketplace, which is go see if they can get a better loan or say, I don't mind, I'll just take the loan here. And on that one, there was some concern that the contract will say something like a 5% loan from GMAC. Well, I think most consumers, when they see GMAC or Ford Credit Union or Ford Motor Credit, will probably know with those car company loans, probably know they know there's a markup in there. But it's just when you say, see Alaska Federal Credit Union or First National Bank, I think it's very clear that you think as a consumer that's the rate the bank is charging. So we have an amendment, if the committee wants, to say our dealer reserve, the dealer reserve part of the bill will only apply when the offer in the contract is coming from a bank or credit union, but not if it's coming from like a GMAC or a Ford credit company. Because in the latter circumstance, there's probably no deception. It's only in the first circumstance there's deception. And then again, on that, all the bill does is it says, it just says you have to advise the consumer that you're keeping a cut if it's with the amendment, if it's from a bank or a credit union. And bank and credit union are already defined in the statutes. So with that, Ed Sniffen from the Attorney General's office was listening to testimony the other day. He had responses to some of the things that came up, and And with the committee's indulgence, Assistant Attorney General Sniffen, I think, would like to address some of the points that came up.
Thank you. And Mr. Sniffen, are you online?
Yes, I am, Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. And I believe, you know, we were short on time, and if you have some further testimony on the bill as well as answering those questions, feel free to go ahead and offer it at this time. And identify
Thank you. For the record, my name is Ed Sniffen. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law in Anchorage. I wanted to just touch briefly on a couple of issues that came up in the last hearing and also on a comment Representative Guerra made on the negotiated price. I did speak with Representative Guerra's office about trying to define the term negotiated price to make that more clear. And it seemed like all of our definitions turned out to be more complicated and convoluted than just leaving the term negotiated price as it is. And I think in the industry, most people understand what that term is. It's no more vague than other terms that we use in the statute. So it was our position that leaving it like it is would accomplish the goal of the statute and was clear enough for our enforcement purposes that we didn't need to change it. One of the other
okay. Before you go on, Mr. Sniffen, Representative Ramos had a question.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
Good morning, sir. I'm just curious, why do you found the other phrases more confusing?
Through the chair, one of the ways I thought about trying to define negotiated price was something like the price negotiated between the consumer and the dealer for the sale of the vehicle. And when I thought about that, I thought, well, that doesn't really add anything to it. And then I thought, well, maybe we could define it to say the negotiated price is the sales price of the vehicle as reflected on the purchase and sale agreement. And then I thought, well, then we'd have to define what a sales price is. And sales price can be kind of complicated because you have the price that actually turns out to be on the contract. You've got the price that they scribble down on that piece of paper that you negotiate with them when they're running back and forth to that mystery room where they have people tell them whether they can make these deals or not. So what the sales price turned out to be was complicated and not very consistent. So at the end of the day, it turned out that negotiated price was as good a definition as anything. And I think we understand, or most consumers understand, when they go into a dealership and they discuss the price of the vehicle with the dealer and they end up with a negotiated price, they know what that is. It's the price you arrive at through those negotiations. So couldn't really come up with a better way to define it other than to just leave it like it was.
Thank you. And Mr. Sniffen, Representative Amherst has a follow-up, and then Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sniffen, that's kind of my trouble with this, is if you got to go through five or six or seven incarnations just to get back to the original language. I mean, this is the whole nature of trying to separate out what the purchase of a vehicle is from the dock fees. I mean, if you're having a difficult time giving it a legal definition, I think that's precisely the trouble that the committee is having, is I need a minute, Mr. Chairman, to
Sure, that's
question.
Fine. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Sniffen. Just on that point, I'm less concerned about the phrase "in addition to the advertised or negotiated price" than the other half of the equation, which is the, quote, additional fees and costs. And you have, Representative Guerra has on line 11, fees or costs include the dealer prep, document prep, search fees, surcharges, and other, quote, fees and costs. The question of what are fees and costs, car dealers are sharp, both in the intellectual sense and in the bargaining sense of the connotation of that word. How can we be sure that they won't impose additional sums in addition to, quote, fees and costs?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that's a good question, and I don't know that we could ever predict what car dealers are going to try and do with this kind of language to see if there is some way they could add on an increment of value that's not a fee or a cost, but typically fees and costs encompass and have been historically defined to encompass all of the associated fees or charges that you are, as a consumer, required to pay as part of the automobile transaction. There are other things like perhaps interest that needs to be disclosed under, you know, state and federal law. There might be some other type of charge that I can't think of now that perhaps some savvy dealers will think of in the future that they could argue is not a fee or a cost, but I have a hard time understanding what that is. And this language in this bill, I think, it gets us 95% there anyway. I mean, it's going to take care of the majority of all the transactions.
Mr. Sniffen, this is Representative Seaton again. So from the Attorney General's, the Department of Law standpoint, from consumer, what's, again, your title? Consumer what?
Yes, I'm sorry. I work in the Consumer Protection Unit at the Department of Law.
Okay, from Consumer Protection, just to find out and get it on the record, then you're saying that the terms fees or costs should include any additional charges that would be added on by a dealer at the time, except for those that are paid, that are specifically exempted, fees actually paid to state agency for licensing, rates, registration, and title transfer. Is that what you're saying?
Through the chair, yes, that is exactly correct. It's our position that consumers are best served when they understand the price they have to pay for a car, absent those fees and costs that a dealer actually pays to the state of Alaska for title and registration. And that's because some of these other fees and costs, and I think we've talked about this before, and there's testimony in the record about this, but they can be confusing and misleading to a consumer as being costs actually paid to someone else when, in fact, they're just costs and fees that the dealer keeps. So in response to your question, yes, that is exactly correct.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Guerra, did you have something to add to this?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I also don't think it needs to be changed, but if you want to add an all-encompassing word, you've all said it, the word charges, you might add the word charges in there, though surcharges is in there, but you might say surcharges, charges, fees, and costs.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
What I would suggest that we might consider would be on lines 13 and 14, and any other fees, costs, and charges of any kind. How would you, Mr. Sniffen, and you, Representative Guerra, feel about that?
I would ask Mr. Sniffen, I think really all you have to do is put the word charges in after surcharges and not go any further than that. But it's up to Mr. Sniffen should know best.
Mr. Sniffen, are you on?
Through the chair, thank you. I think all of that language is good. Anything that would make it clear that fees, costs, charges includes everything other than fees and costs paid to the state for title and registration would be good. I think the language now probably encompasses most of that, but if we need clarifying language, adding, you know, any charges would certainly, you know, be a good thing.
Okay, we can talk about that in an amendment time. Representative Ramirez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you think we could insert the word and profit in there also so that we could let the consumers know that the car dealers are there to try to generate a profit?
Of course. Representative Ramirez, is that a rhetorical question? I mean, I'm just asking if you really want the AG.
No. We're going over everything that seems to be involved. Don't we want to make the consumer aware that we're going to let the dealership generate a profit in this transaction? What do you think about that, Mr. Sniffen?
Through the chair, I think it's understood that car dealers generate a profit, and I would believe most consumers understand that.
I disagree. I think we're we're going ahead and line iteming everything else, shouldn't we contemplate letting the consumer know that the dealer is actually in business that day to make a profit by sale of the transaction?
Through the chair, I don't know that that's really necessary. I don't think this bill is intended to let the car dealers not make a profit, but it's just to disclose all of the types of charges that are added on to a transaction that could potentially be misleading, and I don't know that profit falls into that category.
Mr. Sniffen, I guess I just want to clarify. This is just saying that all of those things have to be in the negotiated price, so you're not saying how much profit is being made. All it is saying that all of your charges and all and your profit, your full negotiated price is your full negotiated price. So, I mean, this wouldn't eliminate profit. It would just mean that your profit is also included in your negotiated price. Isn't that correct?
Through the chair, I believe that is correct, yes.
Okay. May I ask a question? Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that that including that profit in this would not at all diminish the intent of the bill, because this would mean that the negotiated price includes everything. Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sniffen and Representative Guerra, I'm certainly not an expert in this area. And I think you've already answered this, Mr. Sniffen, but has the industry come up with anything else that it might want to charge or feel it should legitimately charge that we would be excluding here? I don't want to be unreasonable to the industry. I just want to be sure that the law is drafted as accurately as possible.
Through the chair, I'm not aware of anything else that we need to include at this time, and I believe if we go back to Representative Guerra's original intent in offering this legislation, I, of course, don't want to put words in his mouth, and we'll let him speak to this. We're targeting a fairly specific practice here of charging these document preparation fees. Document preparation fees have a title that sounds ominous. Consumers don't understand what that means. It sounds awfully like a state-required fee that a dealership has to pay. Some dealers actually represent to consumers that fee is a fee that they have to charge, which is completely false and is misleading. And it's that kind of conduct that I think this bill targets. And of course, as you work through those concepts, this language has been amended a little bit. We want to make sure we include other fees, so if they don't call it a doc prep fee, if they want to call it something else, we want to make sure we include that. So I don't know that we want to get this portion of the bill headed in a direction it wasn't intended to head into, but it's to stop that fairly specific practice that seems to confuse and mislead a number of consumers. So I don't know that we want to expand it too much to be unfair to the car dealers. As Representative Ramirez had mentioned, we don't want to get too carried away and have to make the car dealers line item out every single thing that they're making on this deal. We just want to be fair to consumers.
May I ask one more? Mr. Sniffen, I just want to make sure I'm reading this. Does this bill require them to line item out everything they're charging, or does it only require them to include in the price that they negotiate all the fees that they're going to charge?
Through the chair, it is the latter. It's you just need to include in your price everything you're going to charge. And so when the consumer gets to signing the final purchase order and he looks at however the dealer wants to line item out the charges he wants to charge, they all total up to the price that the consumer agreed to pay.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions for Mr. Sniffen? And Representative Ramirez, did you want to
Yeah, sure, yes, Mr. Chairman.
One thing I do want to bring up is...
Yes, sir.
We were talking a minute ago about profit, and I think profit could be in a different portion, but probably wouldn't it be included on line 11, because that's the definition of fees and costs. So it could be in the other section of the bill, probably in line 8 or something.
Well, the question I want to... I need to get a further definition from Mr. Sniffen, I think, which is the words that I need help with are the words advertised and negotiated. Do you have a definition for those two words, Mr. Sniffen?
Through the chair, advertised price is in the statute currently, and there is no definition for that term in the statute. And negotiated price does not have a separate definition as well. The way I understand those terms to mean an advertised price is the price that you advertise for the vehicle. That can include advertisements in the newspaper, on the radio, on your dealership lot, if it's the big postcard or placard in the window of the vehicle. It's any price that you advertise to the public in any way that offers to sell the vehicle at that price. And then negotiated price is the price that the consumer agrees with the dealer to purchase the vehicle for.
All right. So I need.
Representative Brammer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then I need help. But first of all, that's your own interpretation of the word advertised is what you're telling me. And then you gave me your interpretation of the word negotiated. So now I'd like you to give me your interpretation of the phrase advertised or negotiated.
Through the chair, my interpretation of advertised or negotiated would mean that if you advertise a vehicle for a specific price, that price needs to include all the fees discussed in this bill. If I go into your dealership and I start negotiating with you for the purchase of the vehicle, and we no longer are looking at the advertised price of the sales price, but another price, and it's a price that I discuss with you as the dealer, that I'm willing to purchase the vehicle for, that is the negotiated price, and it is no longer the advertised price.
All right, follow up, Mr. Chair. So, at what point does the transaction take place? Because I'll remind the committee that I just bought a car here a couple of months ago, and I paid a $200 documentation fee, and I know what the advertised price of the car was, and I know what the negotiated price of the car was. And those were two different prices. But at what point, it didn't seem like the transaction took place until after that. It's not as though I purchased the car for one price, Mr. Chairman or Mr. Sniffen, and then when I got a bill in the mail, you know, a month later for a different price. So I need to understand, I'm trying to understand where the actual consumer transaction takes place at, because it says, in addition to the advertised or negotiated price, that would seem to encompass the transaction that I participated in. I went in to buy a $3,000 car. I sat down to consummate the transaction. They said there's a $200 documentation fee. That became part of the negotiated price. They added up the sales tax and the $15 title transfer. And I wrote the check, and it was at that point, Mr. Chairman, that there was actually a transaction. So I'm not sure.
And through the chair, maybe I can help with that scenario a little bit, if you will indulge me. In that situation, it sounds like you were negotiating a price for the vehicle, and during your negotiations, the dealership told you that price would include a dock fee, $199 is the typical amount or whatever it is. And, you know, this bill would not prevent that from happening. If the dealer wants to include a document breadth fee in the price of the car, then he needs to negotiate that with you at the time of negotiations. So if you see a car for $3,000 on the lot and you see it for $3,000, that $3,000 would be the advertised price if it was advertised on the car, if it was in the paper, if you knew it was $3,000 for some reason. That was the advertised price before you started negotiations.
And Mr. Sniffen, let me just interrupt. At that point in time, that $3,000 has to include the documentation fee. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, that is correct. Current law requires that $3,000 price to include the document preparation fee. And then when you start negotiating perhaps a lower price, you say, well, I'm not going to give you $3,000. I'll give you $2,500, though. And the dealer says, well, I'll take $2,500, but I have to add a $199 doc fee in there. And you say, okay, your consent to that charge is now part of the negotiated price because that was included in the negotiations between you and the dealer. What this bill would not allow the dealer to do is to say, okay, $2,500, you've got a deal, Mr. Ramirez. Let's go do up the paperwork, and then you sit down there and start eating the free little mints on the table. And the dealership comes back with the paperwork, and as you said, now you're confused because the paperwork shows a final price of $2,700. And you say, well, what's this $2,700? I thought we agreed on $2,500. And the dealer said, oh, that's a doc prep fee. I'm sorry, we have to add that to the cost of the car. That's the practice that we're trying to prevent here. We want the dealers to tell you everything that you're going to have to pay for the car during those negotiations. So when you get to signing the documents, there aren't these additional fees that are added that really are nothing more than just profit.
Well, there we go. There we are, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
I mean, there we are. We're back to the most evil word on the planet, which is profit. I mean, that is what happened to me. I bought a car for $3,000. I went in to close, and there was the dock fee. But I thought we were still negotiating. Nobody was holding a gun to my head to buy that car. And I could have got up and left, and I could have got up and said, I'm not going to pay that dock fee, and It was talking to somebody in the administration who walked away from a dock fee at a dealership in Anchorage over precisely that issue.
Representative Ramos?
Yes, sir.
The question is, did you know at that time as a consumer that the dock fee was not a document, was not anything other than additional price being added onto the car? Did you think that's the point of the bill, is that many consumers are led to believe that this is a separate charge that is necessary to complete the deal other than the negotiation with the dealer. And it's that impression. Nobody is saying that those can't be charged. It's just being said that they can't be a hidden charge that is added on later after there's been an agreement made on the price of the car.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's precisely the axle that I'm getting wrapped around, which is, what does this word hidden mean? I mean, it was part of the transaction. It happened before I wrote the check. So what's hidden if I wrote it, if I was informed about it before I wrote the check? That's, until the moment that I wrote the check, I had an opportunity to get up and leave the dealership. And so
And Representative Ramirez, yes, your feeling is that the current law that we have, that those document fees have to be in the advertised price, should not be there as well, that should be the negotiation at the end, that the current law, we shouldn't have that because that forces us to include that in the advertised price as well. I mean, is that where we're really coming to here?
I didn't follow you, Mr. Chairman, but I think so.
Okay. Representative Lynn had a question.
Well, it's tough like this why I hate to buy a car. You know, I always lose, every time I go in, my blood pressure goes up. This documentation fee, you know, I don't care whether it's in the price that I'm negotiating or if it comes after I negotiate the price. I want to know that this doc fee is pure profit and not has nothing to do with documents that somebody has to execute someplace. It needs to be defined. It's just pure profit, as I understand it, and I don't care if it comes before or after. We need to know that this is pure profit. I'm not opposed to profit. That's what businesses are in business for, is to make a profit. It's called capitalism. No problem with that. But we need to have fair and honest practices, and people need to be informed. And I think many of us in this room, perhaps, have fallen victim to this practice. I know I have in the past, and I don't like it.
Thank you, Representative Groomer.
Mr. Guerra, Representative Guerra, I have Mr. Sniffen, actually, I have a question on a slightly different topic, if I may. but it may fall under this bill. Several years ago, when we had the used car bill in this committee, as several members will recall, I added an amendment that required that if, when you go in and get a car repaired, the people behind the counter, the person who's the service manager who talks to you, if that person is on a commission, and if they sell you more repairs, they get a bigger commission. If that's the arrangement as it is in some dealers, they have to put up a sign and say, the people behind the counter work on a commission here. We didn't put in anything that it's an unfair trade practice if they don't, if they have such an arrangement and they don't put up the sign. Mr. Sniffen, do you know, are they complying with that law now?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I am very familiar with that amendment, as a matter of fact, and we haven't heard any complaints from consumers about that practice, and so I assume that the dealerships are complying with the law, but and I have no information that they are not, but we have not, you know, done any kind of investigation to check.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Mr. Sniffen, did you have any other points that you wanted to look at in this bill?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, just very briefly, the second part of this bill, to shift our focus just for a moment on the dealer reserve, there were some comments made in the last committee that I wanted to clarify for the committee, and there were some comparisons being made to having to disclose that you are marking up your financing in these auto transactions. But that in virtually every other kind of transaction that takes place on the planet, you don't have to do this. You don't do it in your mortgage transactions. You don't do it when you buy groceries or when you engage in a lot of other financial transactions. And I didn't want the committee to be misled by some of that information. The car buying experience is a very unique experience, and it's one of the only times that I know of where you can actually go into a place and negotiate the price for a product. In almost every other kind of transaction, you don't have that opportunity. When you buy furniture, you generally don't have that opportunity, although that's not always the case. It generally is that you pay the price that the seller puts on the product, or you don't buy it. You've got a situation where you go into a dealership and there are a bunch of people who sort of ascend on you right away, and they do this sort of dance with you about you know, how you have to go through these hoops to buy a car. It's a very unique transaction that really isn't comparable to a lot of other kinds of transactions, which is why I think the disclosure of, you know, the marked up interest rates in the dealer reserve is important for this kind of transaction that distinguishes it from a lot of other transactions. In the mortgage world, for example, you'd have an absolute 3-day right of rescission if you, for any reason or no reason at all, decide you don't want to go through with your house deal. You can cancel it.
Okay. Just a minute, Mr. Sniffen. We had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Mr. Sniffen, who do you work for?
I work for the state of Alaska.
Well, I don't know where. I'm sure you are a very nice and thoughtful man. But I will tell you that every transaction is unique to every different kind of industry. And buying a car is unique. Going to Home Depot is unique on a Saturday. Going to any restaurant is unique. Going to a mortgage company is unique. Every different transaction in a different industry is unique. And I would appreciate it if you could try to manage your comments in such a way that you're not referencing eating mints on the table or the dance they do or going back into the hidden black room. I think that your comments show a pretty clear bias against the automobile industry, and I appreciate the specific nature of your opinion, but I could do without the editorializing of the industry.
Okay, and I want to bring everybody's attention back to that we are in the legislature looking at a bill here, and we do have testimony, and people can offer their opinions, though. I understand where you're coming from as far as the state of Alaska. I would like to make sure, Mr. Sniffen, could you address the point of in mortgages or other transactions, the interest rate that's offered, does that allow, under our laws, the addition of additional interest rate added by the real estate broker, such as in real estate or in other transactions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, just.
I would like to raise a point of order.
Okay, Representative Grunberg.
I've kept my silence until now, but I can't any longer. I've known Mr. Sniffen professionally for a long time. He has the highest reputation. It is most important that witnesses before this committee be allowed to testify freely. He is a professional, and he should be treated with the appropriate courtesy by the members of this committee.
And thank you, and I think that we
my my apologies if I stepped over that line, Mr. Sniffen, but be careful how we characterize industries in this state that contribute to our economy.
And for the record, that was Representative Ramirez. Going back to our previous point, Mr. Sniffen, you, as a consumer protection division, is additional interest allowable for real estate agents or other other such sales?
Through the chair, thank you. As far as I know, no, they are not. Real estate agents, of course, and brokers and lenders are free to charge whatever interest rate they would like to charge, and there may be better interest rates the consumer can get out there. But when you, I think, consummate those transactions, and I've purchased, you know, a few homes myself, the interest rate that you pay is certainly up front, and you know what it is, and you have the opportunity to shop around, but there's no additional sort of holdback in those types of transactions that I'm aware of. And I appreciate the comments from Representative Ramirez, and I do apologize if I seem to be picking on the auto industry. I work with the auto industry very closely, and we have a very good relationship, and I do have a lot of respect for them, and I did not mean to overstep that line in any way, and I apologize if I have. I just wanted to make sure we were comparing apples to apples and oranges to oranges, and some of the comments in the last meeting seemed to indicate that wasn't the case. So anyway, with that, I will end my comments and then be happy to answer any questions.
thank you, Mr. Sniffen, but you you may add anything else that you feel appropriate, and there's, you know, the committee is not taking umbrance at all at your testimony here. So if there's something else that you would like to add, for our enlightenment, because we are talking about passing a statute here, and we want to make sure that we understand the full implications.
Thank you, Chairman. I'll end there and be happy to answer any other questions that anyone might have.
Okay, thank you. And we have Representative Lynn and Representative Grunberg.
Yes, thank you. I might point out that all of us in life, and certainly in the legislature, we all probably express our biases every time we speak about anything. We're all very unique individuals. That said, a carbine is a unique thing, and I am a licensed real estate agent, and that's also, we only really negotiate two things in this country, that's automobiles and houses. Other countries negotiate everything, even taxi cab rides. But I wanted to ask Mr. Sniffen, our the sponsor of the bill, does anything in the bill as written that require that the dock fee be indicated as pure profit, whether it comes before or after the negotiated price? Personally, I'd like to see the fact that the so-called dock fee is pure unadulterated profit and nothing else, regardless of where it comes in the transaction. Does the bill do that now? And if not, should we change it so it does?
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While I would be tempted to do that, Representative Lynn, I don't think we should, because I don't think you could do it accurately. I think probably what a car dealer would do, would say, would be in some cases it's not 100% pure profit. Maybe it's only 97% pure profit, right? There's a 3% cost for them to buy the paperwork that they have to sell you. So you can't say that it's 100% pure profit. Some of it goes to the cost of the piece of paper. I personally share, I think, the concern I've heard you say in the past, which is they certainly, in many cases, mislead consumers into making them believe that this is some sort of cost that doesn't exist. And you know, I run a restaurant, Representative Ramirez runs a restaurant, and we charge $3.99 for a burger. It's $3.99. We don't do $3.99 plus doc. We don't try and convince people that there's another fee in there for the cashier's check or for the credit card slip that we have to pay. We don't charge a buck for the credit card slip, even though that only costs us 10 cents. But, you know, when you get to the point where you don't want to have to do some sort of accounting thing where you're trying to determine how much of the doc fee is profit and how much of it is out-of-pocket cost, I suspect almost all of it is profit, and that's truthfully what the car dealer said, but we don't know if it's 100% or 99% or 97%.
And Representative Guerra, I'd just say that if that was included in here, I'd probably vote against the bill because I don't think our delineation here is getting into saying what is appropriate profit for a dealer. The only thing it's saying is that when you finalize your negotiated price, it will include all your fees and charges. And, you know, I would not want to get into saying that a dealer has to disclose what is profit or what is not. It's just that when you negotiate, you have to negotiate for the full price. And that's, as I understand, the purpose of the bill. And I can support that concept. I would not support a concept of getting into an individual's business transaction to say what are costs and what are profits in those. That it is a negotiation, and as long as everything is on the table in the negotiation, I'm satisfied with that.
On that point,
Representative Lynn, on that point.
Well, I understand that, Mr. Chair, but. You know, when I'm negotiating the price of a car, I'm thinking about the car, and that's the price I'm paying. And I don't care what price we negotiate for the car. I don't care what the profit is, except for my own pocketbook. But it's a dock fee is part of that. You know, that's not car anymore. That's something else. But I'll go with the wisdom of the chairman. But I just believe in full and honest disclosure. And we make a deal, and there's no reason why I can't get a good car, and the dealer make a decent profit.
Sure. And Representative Grunberg.
I'd like to go into the second part of the bill here. I know that, and I'm really mostly asking this to the sponsor of the bill, Representative Guerra. On the proposed amendment, at the bottom, lines 14 and 15, actually line 15, it says from a bank or credit union, it excludes other types of financing arrangements like GMAC or something like that. And I'm not sure why, because from the consumer's point of view, it should make no difference whether the financing is from Denali, Federal Credit Union, North Rim Bank or GMAC, if the dealer is getting a kickback or getting charging more than the institution would charge, if the, for example, if the consumer went directly to the institution or shopped around, I think the consumer has a right to know that, and I'd like to know of a good reason why we shouldn't include any financing arrangement in that. I really would like to see that in there. Is there a good reason why we don't? Representative Guerra, through the chair.
Through the chair. Representative Grunberg, you're talking about the dealer reserve fee, and let's be clear what this is. The dealer arranges financing for you. You go and you sign the contract. The contract says 5.5% loan from Denali Federal Credit Union. You believe that that loan came from Denali Federal Credit Union, and Denali Federal Credit Union is charging you 5.5%,
right.
And you sign it.
Right.
Lo and behold, you find out Denali Federal Credit Union is only charging you 4%.
Mm-hmm.
And the dealer's keeping 1.5%, and they didn't tell you about it.
Right.
And let me step back for a moment. I don't believe that I think Denali Federal Credit Union is one of the banks that doesn't do this. So I probably used the wrong example.
Yeah, whatever.
There are only a couple banks that do this anymore because it's so fraudulent. We want the bill to address the fraudulent aspects of car dealer transactions.
Mm-hmm.
And Representative Ramirez and I have philosophical disagreements about whether we should do that. I think it's important. But we don't want to regulate things that don't need to be regulated. So the amendment tries to strike this balance and cut out some paperwork that would be unnecessary. When a consumer sees that the bank is offering a 5% loan, they believe it's really coming from the bank and that's the charge that's being charged. Now, some people have said, oh, consumers know the bank's not really charging that fee and the car dealer's keeping some. I don't believe that. Mm-hmm. Consumers are being misled, and you have it in your packet. It cost one consumer about $1,000 on a $29,000 car. That's the value of a permanent fund dividend. Mm-hmm. However, there are times where a consumer is not misled, where the loan is coming from a car company like GMAC or Ford Credit Union. I think you can make the argument that the consumer expects that somebody's making some money in there. There's probably some sort of relationship between the car dealer and the loan company. Maybe, maybe not. So what I was offering as a proposed amendment, and I think it addresses some of the concerns made in the last hearing, where are consumers being misled and where are they not? I think they're clearly being misled in the circumstance where the loan's coming from a bank or a credit union. They think that's the charge being charged by the bank or the credit union. Where it's being charged by an entity that really the only other entities out there that are making the loans are the GMACs and the Ford Motor Credit Unions, the car-affiliated credit companies. They know that I think they do know that there's some sort of relationship between those entities and the person selling the car and that there's probably some profit in there.
Mr. Chair. I don't think that my constituents, I don't think that I would know that. You did.
No, I don't.
Oh, you don't?
I agree.
Wait a minute. And that was Representative Lynn's response. Remember this.
I beg your pardon.
Our recording secretary is going to have to transcribe these, so please make sure we go through.
Sorry. Yeah, that was a dialogue between Representative Lynn
Representative
and me.
Grunberg.
Thank you. I want to err on the side of disclosure and consumer protection here. I don't think it makes a difference what the institution is. It's the question of the practice. Because banks and credit unions are only two types of lending institutions. You might have the Ace Mortgage Company or Fast Auto Loans. I don't know if there is such a company.
Okay, Representative Grunberg, then you do not want to offer the amendment.
Just a minute. Can I? Mm-hmm. Okay. What I'd like to do, and I'm asking Representative Guerra, and it may take a minute, please, is to get away from saying who the lending institution is, any lender, so that if there is a markup, that it is disclosed. Would you have a problem if we did it in that manner?
Through the chair, Representative Rumberg, what you just said, your proposal is exactly what the bill does now. I see no problem in giving consumers information. That's all this bill does. In its current form, all it does is give consumers information. And for anybody to say that that's a burden on industry, it's not. It's a word and a piece of paper. So I have no problem with the way the bill is written right now.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. So we're back to what I was stating before: is unless you want to make that differentiation, do not offer the amendment. And that exactly your point is in the bill.
Thank you.
I don't see any other members here that are going to offer this amendment.
Could I just finish what I was going to say, please?
Representative Grummer.
Would you have a problem if we don't offer the amendment?
I will tell you, I will speak to you in terms of strategy, which people don't normally do here. I think I speak for Mr. Sniffen, and he should correct me if I'm wrong. I think he also believes the amendment is not needed. It's certainly up to the committee. I don't have strong feelings either way.
Thank you.
Okay. Do we have further comments from the committee?
No.
Let's see. We didn't have anyone else online to testify. Did we have anyone in the audience? We do have somebody in the audience to testify to the bill. So I will reopen the public hearing because we want to make sure. Because I want to make sure that we get all the testimony. Please come forward and identify yourself for the record. I didn't have the sign-up sheet here. Sorry. Didn't know you were.
My name is John Cook. I'm with the Alaska Auto Dealers Association. I'm the legislative director, and I testified to you regarding this bill approximately 2 weeks ago. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to address a couple of points. First, regarding the proposed amendment, actually, those lending relationships are all the same, so you are correct, those that pointed out that difference. There is absolutely no difference between GMAC and a bank. I guess on behalf of our membership, again, we oppose this bill. Our organization has 70 new and used car dealerships as members across the state. We employ 2,400 people at the new car dealerships alone and have annual payroll in excess of $120 million plus benefits. All but two of our members are locally owned, family-operated businesses. I'm a third-generation Alaskan. Our business has been in existence. Our company, Aurora Motors in Fairbanks, has been in existence for 60 years. And I guess a lot of the testimony is centered around what I would call unfair or deceptive type practices. I can tell you we wouldn't be in business for 60 years if we operated in that manner, nor if any of our members consistently operated in that manner. The legal community would have us out of business if we operated consistently in that manner. So that's the first thing I'd like to point out. Secondly, with regard to Mr. Sniffen's testimony, I would add that our association and myself personally and many of our members have a very close and good working relationship with Mr. Sniffen. I will respectfully disagree with him on a couple of points. First, advertised price is not defined in the statute. However, Mr. Sniffen has made extremely clear to all of us what the advertised price is. We know what it is. It's explicit. It may not be defined in statute, but it's explicit. Where I would disagree with him is that I do not have yet. He said that we know what a negotiated price is. I do not know what a negotiated price is. Is that an oral agreement? Is it a written agreement? Tell me what a negotiated price is, because if this statute is passed and we get to live with the consequences and it's not defined, then the legal community is going to get to hash it out. So I do not feel comfortable with the fact that there is no definition of negotiated price. Sounds like there were several attempts to come up at one, and if an attorney can't come up with a negotiated price and give us a clear and concise definition, I know I certainly can't. So that's one thing I would like to point out there. Secondly, regarding many of these unfair trade practices or, you know, deceptive practices, these are already prohibited currently in statute. They're prohibited under the Unfair Trade Practices Act. Furthermore, the Unfair Trade Practices Act carries severe fines and penalties, which I don't know if this bill does or doesn't. So we have a big stick out there to prevent us from committing unfair or deceptive practices. We also face class action suit if you know you continue to do these things and there's a large number of transactions that are deceptive. Our businesses face class action suits. So we have possible civil penalties from the state, and we have litigation from attorneys that we face every single day. Regarding dock fees, not all dealerships charge dock fees. I want to make that very clear. There's many that do not. In our dealership, we disclose them separately. It's delineated separately, and I believe that's the standard practice of, for sure it's a standard practice of all the major dealerships that are members of our association. I will tell you that every aspect of a car deal other than the DMV fees, which are charged by the state of Alaska, is negotiable. I mean, perhaps we would be better off to say that everything other than DMV fees with regard to a vehicle transaction is negotiable, and we can do away with all this language, because that's the reality. Every single component of a vehicle transaction is negotiable. Okay? So I would point that out. We cannot, and generally most dealerships will not negotiate the dock fees. I will tell you, if a consumer comes to us and has an objection with the dock fee, we will reduce the selling price of the vehicle before we will reduce the dock fee. The reason for doing this is that if I charged you a different dock fee from you, that could be considered a discriminatory lending practice, which is prohibited under Reg Z, which is a federal regulation that supersedes any state statute. So, you know, again, that the dock fee is there. It is delineated. Dealers do consistently charge it. plan, and the reason that it's a consistent flat fee and isn't negotiable from person to person, or the reason that most people will reduce the selling price, is for exactly that reason.
Excuse me, if I could just ask, I'm trying to understand. We had testimony from other auto dealers that the dock fee was really just profit, and that, and your indication is that this is a flat fee that you wouldn't charge, you wouldn't want to differentiate between buyers because it is something other than just a portion, just another portion of profit that's built into the.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me clarify that. I'm a certified public accountant. That's one of the other little titles I can hang on my hat. The dock fee is, you know, it is not pure profit. It is revenue. It is revenue. I mean, that is how it is correctly classified. It is not profit. It is revenue. Our practice, and most dealers' practices, is to charge a consistent dock fee. It makes it consistent for everybody. So whether it's $99 or $199 or $189, The most dealerships charge, all dealerships that I'm aware of charge generally the same fee to everyone. It is delineated. It is revenue. Does that answer your question?
We seem to be getting into a difference here because we've had some dealers tell us that it's fully negotiable, that they, you know.
No, we're not getting into a difference at all. It is negotiable. I will just tell you that my practice, for the reason, and most and many dealerships' practices, is if you say I am not going to pay $189 dock fee, I'm going to walk away from this deal. My wording to you and my employees' wordings to you would be, sir, we would like to keep $189 dock fee the same. We will reduce the selling price of the vehicle by $189. Does that make sense? Because if I charged a different fee, why we do that is for the reasons I enunciated earlier. So you would negotiate it. If we decide to reduce the price, I would do it on the selling price. I wouldn't do it on the dock fee, but I would negotiate the fee for you. But if you start actually showing that fee, if I reduced it to zero, but I let you have it at 100, then I could be open to discriminatory lending practices. And that's not, again, we've got all these rules we have to comply with, you know, so by... we can negotiate the deal, but by doing one thing, we could be setting ourselves up for legal action in another area, and that's a federal statute. So,
that's helpful because we've gotten testimony from different automobile dealers, you know, that treat this in an entirely different way.
So the majority of our membership treats it, you know, exactly the way that that I've just described to you.
Thank you. Sorry for interrupting you, but I thought it was important to clarify that for the committee.
Definitely. With regard to dealer reserve, the amendment issues, I guess, have already been covered. But I would add a couple of points. First of all, I guess after, you know, having been in the automobile business and operated as a certified public accountant for nearly 18 years, I would term myself a sophisticated borrower. I've entered many business and personal transactions and audited many business and personal transactions throughout the course of my professional career. I have never had any financing transaction, whether it's through a bank, buying a boat, buying a snowmobile, buying a car, buying a house. I've never had anyone disclose to me that I may be able to get a better rate somewhere else. And so, I mean, I would point out that I've never seen in any industry where someone has required to say, you may be able to get a better rate down the street or anywhere else. So, I think it's something that, you know, seems to be specifically looking at you know, at our industry. And I can tell you that mortgage brokers, they're not originators of paper. They receive fees for selling mortgages. Of course, you know, that industry is not regulated by the state of Alaska. Federal lending is not. So Mr. Sniffen is correct in that in-house transactions you have the right of rescission and other things, but federal law supersedes state statute. That doesn't make it right, but that is the reason that that's different. And I will point out that RVs, boats, snowmobiles, they have the same dealer agreements with banks that car dealers do. They are exactly the same. There's absolutely no difference. Dealer reserve is charged on all those transactions. The relationship is identical. But we're sitting here as the only people that are being discussed, you know, in this bill. You know, lastly, I guess, regarding all these things, I will tell you that our advertising statute that we currently follow here is amongst the most rigorous in the United States. I see ads from all over the country. We do a good job of following that statute to the letter of the law. A lot of other states, when you go pick up their papers, they don't compete or they don't disclose all of these fees in their deals. They're not required to in their advertised price. We have to compete against other dealers on the internet. You can go find out. You can go find out exactly what a car cost me to produce. You can go find out the invoice price of a brand new GMC on the internet today. So, you know, we're competing against dealerships all across the country, and we're held to one of the highest standards of anywhere in the, in this country. And I don't see how, you know, I don't know. I don't know how much further there is to go. We already do it the right way, and with the negotiated price. Again, I just feel that. I'm not sure what it is. I don't know what a negotiated price is. I guess lastly, you know, we're talking here about all of the supposed problems that this occurs in, and making it sound like it's almost common practice that people are deceived by dock fees or dealer reserve. I've been at this dealership for 13 years. We've sold in excess of 15,000 cars. Other dealers that are down here with me today, I would say our annual sales are I mean, in the tens of thousands per year. I have never once received a complaint from a consumer regarding either of these issues, dock fee or dealer reserve. Furthermore, I have never received a consumer complaint through Mr. Sniffen's office regarding either one of these two issues. All seven of the dealers that are down here with me today have never personally received any complaints from consumers regarding either of these two issues. Last time we testified, a member of this committee said, well, we don't, you know, why do we need to fix, we don't need to fix every other industry, you know, we just need to fix yours. Well, I'm trying to figure out where the problem is with our industry. We have one case of one dealer that was out of state, new to this market, that's been publicized in a story in the Anchorage Daily News. We've had tens of thousands of transactions, and I've never seen a complaint. So I guess my question to the committee would be, I don't see things as being broke. Why do we need to fix them? What is the purpose of this statute? Because personally, I have never had any problems with either of these two issues in my dealership. And I thank you for your time, and I'm available for any questions.
Good, thank you. Questions from the committee, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. I appreciate your testimony. I'm sorry I was ill the last time, so this is my first time hearing the bill, and I wasn't on the Transportation Committee. I think this was before. You're the first witness today who has indicated a question as to the definition of negotiated price. We, with due respect to the chair, have the sponsor of the bill here, Mr. Sniffen online, and yourself here. All three people interested in the bill, the parties, are really here. And I'm wondering, since this may be something that deserves some definition, if, since you're all here, if we can put in the bill a definition that everybody can agree upon, would that be possible? I'm seeing some shaking of heads. No.
I'm gonna, you know, I guess I would say.
Do you have a suggestion of something you could agree on? You could suggest.
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I do not have. I mean, personally, I do not have a definition of what a negotiated price is. I'm not an attorney, and I don't know that that I have those. I don't have those abilities. I can tell you that our legal counsel is sufficiently concerned that he. You know, has told us that he thinks it's too vague. So could there be language that's worked out? That's possible. I guess I would, you know, we didn't introduce this legislation. I would rather see something come from the other parties, and we'd be willing to look at any of that.
So. I'm through the chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Legislators are notoriously reactive.
Mm-hmm.
We introduce individual bills individually, or committee chair does. But the rest of us react to it. And we do a lot better. Since you have a you just being a person, and I'm talking to the world here. If a person has a problem, if they come with a yesable proposition, then we can deal with that and the other interested parties can. I hope this bill moves out of this committee. It's got a ways to go before it goes to the governor's desk. You do have an attorney, and I'm sure he or she's very competent. I would suggest that if you think there should be some definition, that you propose one to Representative Guerra and Mr. Sniffen and see if you can work it out. If you can't, then to the next committee, wherever that is, you can bring your differences. But we can't on the fly do this, so I suggest that. And I'm going to next ask, if it's okay through the chair, a question that you had raised. I've written down several things you've raised, to Mr. Sniffen and to Representative Guerra.
Just a minute. Representative Gruber, do you have any more questions
for
Mr. Cook?
I'm sort of going in order of the stuff he did. May I, please?
I don't want to be cycling back and forth through different witnesses here. So
I would like to know if this is a violation of the, if a violation of this is in fact a violation of the unfair trade practice.
Okay, if Mr. Sniffen, are you still online?
Yes, Chairman, I am. Thank you.
Representative Grunberg has a question.
Mr. Cook had said he wasn't sure whether a violation of this bill would be a violation of the Unfair Trade Practices Act. Would it be, sir?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, yes, it would. This proposed amendment comes in Title 4525 and specifically in this Section 400 area, which is the area that regulates dealer practices, and any violation of that, the 400 section of this statute, is also a consumer protection violation.
Thank you. Now, you had, through the chair, the third point, you had said several times that basically everything is negotiable. The bottom line in the deal is negotiable. And, you know, putting some disclosure like that for, you see, I represent a part of town that may not be the most sophisticated. I represent the Mountain View area, and people there are, some people are, English isn't their first language, not so well educated, not high wage earners. And maybe they do need to be told up front that the deal really is negotiable, because I think people are trusting. And I'm not saying they shouldn't be, but they don't always know that. And requiring a disclosure that please be advised that this transaction is negotiable. Would your industry support such a disclosure?
I can't speak on behalf of the entire board, but I can tell you that from my own personal point of view, you know, people had earlier said that it's, you know, a lot of these things towards what a negotiated price is or whatnot, they're implied. And I guess I would say that, at least from my own consumer base, you don't get very many, I've never seen too many customers that will just come in and pay the price. I think it's something that's already there. I would tell you, if you wanted me to put up a sign that says the deal is negotiable, I wouldn't have any problem with that, because it's what happens every day. I mean, it happens in any event. I mean, it's
at some point, Mr. Chair, I'll ask Representative Guerra about that.
Well, okay, go ahead, Mr. Grunberg, but we need to move along here.
Yes. Okay. No, that really was my last question. I was going to ask something, the relationship of this whole disclosure thing in the Section 3 to Regulation Z, but I think that's getting into a pretty technical area. But I will ask, before we take up the markup of the bill, Representative Guerra, whether he would support something that would say, require it, letting the consumer know that this whole deal is negotiable.
Well, we can get back to that point after we finish. Does anyone else have any questions for Mr. Cook?
Well, I don't have a question. I just have...
Well, wait a minute. We've got Mr. Cook up here.
Well,
I want to make sure that we have something for Mr. Cook. Otherwise, we'll go to committee.
Well, I wanted to respond to a statement that he made.
So that's fine. If
yeah, I don't think any one of us is trying to pick on a particular industry, automobile industry, any other industry. We take up boats here as they come before us, whether automobile industry, cars, boats, RVs, helicopters, whatever, as they come before us. And so when we are discussing a bill like this on cars, it's not appropriate for us to discuss ins and outs of potential problems in other industries. That's not what we had to stick to the bill. And I'm frankly just amazed by this this entire thing. And I understand that vehicles are negotiable when you go to buy one, but I need to know what is truly negotiable and what is actually something like the dock fees and so on. I did not know that they were negotiable, whether you pay lower the dock fee itself or you take it off the other end, whatever. I didn't know that, and I have a reasonably good education, and I still didn't know that. And so we're just in favor of, and I guess the question is, what is the problem with full and public disclosure on what is and is not the actual thing we're trying to buy, which in your case is an automobile?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, I believe in full disclosure. We provide full disclosure. What I would say is that, as I had previously mentioned, we have sold in excess of 15,000 vehicles. I have never had a problem on either of these two industries. None of the seven dealers that are down here today have never had a problem on either of these two issues, I should say. My point is, and the reason that our association does not support this bill is because we do not see that there's a consistent problem. If it was an isolated, I think what we have is an isolated incident and a news story. If it was a consistent problem or there were consistent complaints, then I think legislation is warranted. I do not believe legislation is warranted here because I have not seen the issues that you're talking about manifest themselves in our dealership. Okay. And in 15,000 transactions.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Appreciate that. And Mr. Sniffen, are you still online?
Yes, Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. That has raised Mr. Cook has raised a question for us. Since you are in the consumer protection section, how many or how often do you get complaints or issues raised on either or both of these two issues that we're dealing with?
Through the chair, I can't discuss our complaints in any detail because of confidentiality statutes, but I can tell you in a broad sense that Mr. Cook is absolutely right, that we don't get a lot of written complaints on this dock fee issue specifically, and it's my belief that we don't get that only because consumers don't understand that it's something that they could complain about. And I mention that because I'm involved in a case now where we have audited some files of some dealerships, and in nearly every transaction we've looked at so far, a dock fee was charged inappropriately. And it's been thousands of transactions where there has been a violation. And we had no complaints about those transactions either, and I believe it's simply because a lot of consumers, or most consumers, just don't understand that what these dock fees are and why they pay them.
And Mr. Sniffen, I'm not getting into any details, but are we talking basically about dock fees added on above the advertised price?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner.
And I would like to second that because I think that is really true. Why would people make a complaint if they don't know that the practice is illegal or not a requirement of the state? And I think that when a document fee is charged and listed separately from the negotiated price and it's listed along with the registration and title fees and things like that, as a consumer, I know I just believed that was required. And paid it, and I wouldn't have dreamed of filing a complaint because it wasn't illegal as far as I knew. But I'll tell you one thing. I'm going back to our last documents as we paid an advertised price, and I will file a complaint if the dock fee is on there, as I think it is.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Cook, would you like to respond?
Yes, I would. Mr. Chair, as Mr. Sniffen pointed out, the case in hand that he's discussing regards advertised price. You know, I will again remind everyone that advertised prices are policed by Mr. Sniffen's office very vigorously. They, you know, the definition of negotiated price, we don't know what that is. That's point number one. Point number two, and this is a question, but if you do not have a dock fee in one place and you try to put it in another or disclose it as being a mandatory fee, wouldn't that already be considered a deceptive practice? And isn't that covered under statutes currently on the books?
Could we have an answer from Mr. Sniffen?
I guess, you know, I want to make sure we don't get anybody into hot water anywhere here, or everybody realize what they're putting on the record. I mean, if we're into a situation where we're saying that we are going to be putting these uniformly across all cars because we might run into federal law prohibitions, it's almost as if we're saying that those charges are a separate charge that must be maintained. And if what we're saying under state law, those are not, there is no true separate charge, we want to make sure we don't get, I just want to put everybody under awareness that we don't want to have people commit themselves to statements that they don't want in the future. So, Mr. Sniffen?
Yes, Chairman.
Can you go ahead and respond?
Yes, thank you. And I believe Mr. Cook raises a very good point, and that is a lot of these practices that we're discussing this bill could already be illegal under Alaska's Consumer Protection Act. The problem, though, with the statute the way it is if we had a situation where a dealer was not disclosing a dealer reserve, for example, and the consumer later found out that the dealer had a holdback, and our law, as it's now written, is silent on that. It's not illegal for dealers to do that. It's illegal for them to engage in any kind of deception that would have misled the consumer into believing they were getting financing from the bank when, in fact, that wasn't the true financing from the bank. So let's say you go to a dealer and say, what can you do for me on this car? And the dealer says, well, the best I can do for you is 5%. The dealer doesn't say, the best the bank can give you is 5%. The dealer says, the best I can give you is 5%. Very subtle difference, but very important. If the dealer said, well, the best the bank will do for us is 5%, when in fact the bank has given the dealer a 4% rate and holding back that 1%, well, that's just fraud. That is deception, and it is illegal under our Consumer Protection Act. A lot of consumers may not understand that distinction when they're negotiating for the purchase of this, you know, new vehicle, which is a very significant event for most people. They're excited about it. They think they're getting the best deal they can get. So it really is a matter of trying to prove what the dealer said, what the consumer thought, and you get in front of a court, and it's a he said, she said kind of thing. You know, I wish all dealers were as upfront and honest as Mr. Cook, then we wouldn't have these problems at all. But we have a lot of dealers who, unlike Mr. Cook and his members, who aren't quite as upfront about how they do these transactions. So, yes, they could be unlawful under our act. It's difficult to prove that they are, and it would remove that uncertainty if we had our statute that said you can do it, but if you do it, you have to disclose it and disclose it clearly.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there any further questions for Mr. Cook?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I would appreciate a little latitude here. As we're going to be doing marking up here in a minute, if you could stick around, Mr. Cook, and Mr. Sniffen, and of course Representative Guerra, so that as we have questions, if we could ask them if we need to. Could we do that, Mr. Chair?
I think we'll, if you need to ask those negotiating questions, we'll take in at ease, and you can talk with them individually.
That'd be on the record.
But we're not going to have a negotiation on the record here.
No, I'm not talking about that at all.
So.
Just tell me that.
Are there, seeing no other questions for Mr. Cook, thank you very much.
Thank you much.
I'm sorry, excuse me. Representative Guerra has given me a potential amendment that I'm handing out, and it attempts, I think, to go towards a definition of negotiated price. At least it gets something in the bill, and it can be tweaked later in a committee if that desired. And if you could give Mr. Cook a copy of that.
Mr. Flora.
Mr. Sniffen, I'm reading this out loud so that you can follow along, too. The amendment would say, insert at page 1, line 8, after the phrase negotiated price, comma, there should be a comma there, quote, comma, including the price stated at any point during the negotiation or transaction, unquote. And I would ask, Mr. Chair, if that's agreeable. Representative Guerra, I'm reading that correctly. Yes, he's nodding. I would ask you, Mr. Cook, and you, Mr. Sniffen, if you think that at least put some kind of a definition on the record. I see Representative Gardner has her hand up, too.
Well, we had a question for Mr. Cook. Mr. Cook, do you want to comment on that language at all, or whether that clarifies anything for you? And you can.
Mr. Chairman, again, I can't speak on behalf of my association on this matter. I can tell you personally that looking at this language, I can tell you personally I don't like the wording in there, and I would still be opposed to the wording and the bill.
Thank you, Representative Gardner.
Just a question.
Okay. First of all, do we have anybody else online? We didn't. Did we have anybody else in the audience to testify? The public hearing is closed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Gardner.
Regarding the proposed amendment, wouldn't you want really to say, including the price stated at any point and agreed or accepted? Because if I say, I'll give you X amount for the car, until the other person says, I'll accept X amount.
Yes.
It's not.
That's an excellent point. I had the same, through the chair, I had the same kind of...
Representative Gruenberg.
The same kind of a concern. I ask Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think in order to understand this negotiated price issue, we have to go back into the sort of reality of what the bill does. See, negotiated price never became an issue until this legislature in 2002 passed a bill banning dock fees. And then the industry came in and said, oh, you use the term advertised price, so we're going to charge the dock fee and the negotiated price. The industry knew very well what the negotiated price was, and they do it now. They charge the dock fee and the negotiated price. They were the ones that created the issue. Negotiated price is understood. It is, what we're trying to do is say at no point during the process may you insert a dock fee. In your advertisement, when you negotiate with the consumer, never. So... there are only really two kinds of prices out there. There's the one that you start out the deal with your advertisement, and then there's the one you finish the deal with the one you negotiate, unless you just charge the advertised price and there's no negotiation. So that's everything. And that's why Mr. Sniffen said we don't really need to deal with this. There's the advertised price. We thought when we passed the bill in 2002 that covered everything, but the car dealerships were successful in litigation, and they said, that didn't include the negotiated price, so now we're including the negotiated price. There is no other price anywhere. That's everything. If you want to be clear that that's everything, I've put together this proposed amendment that says it would say advertised price, negotiated price, or price at any other point during the negotiation. But there really is no price at any other point during the negotiation.
And Representative Guerra, I'm going to agree with you that the wording in the bill is sufficient. We are starting from an advertised price, and there is a negotiation from the advertised price. And this other idea is that we are not starting from the advertised price or the listed price, which is the advertised price, even if it's on the window as a MSRV or the manufacturer's suggested retail price. So, you know, we have an advertised price, and we are going from from there, and the only question is, can you add in additional fees that aren't in the advertised price after you go to negotiations? And that's what this bill says, is that you are working from an advertised price, and anything that's included in the advertised price is included in the negotiation. So,
Mr. Chair,
you know, I don't think this clears up anything myself. Representative Groomer.
Yeah, I'm not going to offer this.
Oh, good. Okay. Do we have any other amendments? Representative Groomer.
Now, we had talked about additional charges, and through the chair, Representative Guerra, where would that go on line? Where would that go?
Representative Guerra.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I think the cleanest place to put it would be on page 1, line 12, where it says surcharges, comma, insert the word charges after surcharges, and then charges, comma. So it would be surcharges, comma, charges, comma.
Okay.
And other fees and costs.
And would you support such an amendment?
Sure. I think it would make things a little bit more clear.
Mr. Chair, I would...
offer the conceptual amendment of...
Number one?
Yes.
And that would be after, on page 1, line 12, after surcharges, comma, insert, quote, charges, comma.
Does everyone understand that proposed amendment? Is there any objection to amendment number one? Seeing no objection, number one... amendment number one passes, which adds on page 1, line 12, after the word surcharges, it adds charges.
And I have a question.
Are there any other amendments?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Groomberg.
I am looking at this as carefully as possible because I know the industry and other people will read this really carefully. And any kind of wiggle room, I'm trying to close down. That's the intent of what I'm saying here today. On page 2, line 24, the word, quote, arranges. Somebody could say, I'm not, quote, arranging this. I am simply offering it or something else. And I'm wondering if we should broaden the term, quote, arranges to something, and I'm not sure if offers is even...
Representative Grunberg, can I interrupt? Mr. Sniffen, are you online? Mr. Sniffen, are you still online? Apparently not. Go ahead.
Oh, wow.
So...
I'll ask Mr. Representative Guerra.
The sponsor, Representative Guerra, do you have a...
I'm thinking of broadening the term arranges so they can't wiggle out of it.
Mr. Chair, through the chair, Representative Grunberg, if you wanted to do that, I think what you would have to do is insert on page 2, line 24, after arranges financing for a proposed buyer, comma, you would have to insert or offers financing to the proposed buyer, comma.
That would be fine. So the phrase would be or offers financing to a proposed buyer. Would you support such an amendment?
I would, Representative Grunberg. I will run it by Mr. Sniffen before the bill reaches the floor to make sure, but that seems clear.
That's conceptual. And again, folks, if we all can look at this to see any other wiggle room we want to close down. Mr. Chair,
thank you.
I would offer as conceptual amendment number 2, on page 2, line 24, after proposed buyer, comma, the phrase, quote, or offers financing financing to a proposed buyer, comma. That would be conceptual amendment number two.
Is there any objection to amendment number two? Seeing none, amendment number two, page two, line 24, after proposed buyer or offering financing to a proposed buyer. Or offers financing to a proposed buyer, and that's a conceptual amendment. Seeing none, that amendment's adopted. Are there any other amendments? Seeing no other amendments. Do we have Representative Lynn?
I don't have any. I just want to make a statement before we possibly move this bill. You know, I think the fact that we've had two lengthy committee meetings on this particular bill, and we've all had considerable difficulty understanding the terms involved and what exactly are dock fees, what do they consist of, what exactly are these holdback thing. I think we as a committee has spent so much time on this, trying to understand it as we should. Imagine the plight Mr. Joe Lasker, who comes into the dealership and just faces this thing while they are in the excitement of trying to buy a new car. So if we have this kind of difficulty, much time as we spend on it, we're not even trying to buy a car here. Imagine the plight of a consumer who goes in and faces this situation. What's a dock fee? Et cetera. I think that really speaks to the necessity for this bill.
Thank you. Before we go further, is Mr. Sniffen back online?
Yes, Chairman. I apologize. I had to run to another hearing very briefly.
Yes, appreciate that. Just wanted to get your comment before we possibly take action on this bill. There was an amendment offered that on page 2, line 24, after arranges financing for a proposed buyer, it says, or offers financing to a proposed buyer. Do you have any objection to that phrase being offered in there?
Chairman Seaton, no, I have no objection to that.
Okay, thank you.
Did he hear the first one, too? Do we have to ask him about that?
No, we don't need to. Representative, let's see. Do we have any further comments on the bill? Yes, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I think this is a good bill. There may be elements that can be improved or clarified, but we've kind of done our best on this committee. I see it as consumer protection, and I don't think it in any way interferes with a dealer's right to earn profit and be in business. It's about just disclosure and obligations for disclosure so that consumers make informed choices and decisions when they purchase a vehicle. So.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. Any further discussion, Bill? Is there wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I'd be very happy to move CS for House Bill 383, version X, as amended. And I don't know, do we have any fiscal notes? Just as amended, I guess.
Yes, I do not see any fiscal notes with it at this time. And that was with individual recommendations.
Any individual recommendations.
Okay. I'll object, Mr. Chair.
We have an objection. You want to speak to your objection?
I will, very briefly, Mr. Chairman. I just think this is a lousy bill. Okay. I think it hampers commerce. I appreciate the sponsor enormously, and I appreciate the intent, but I think it's just too fuzzy, and I think it's bad legislation, with all due respect to my friend, Representative Garrett.
Seeing no other further discussion, Secretary, would you please call the roll?
Representative Gardner.
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yes.
Representative Gatto, not present. Representative Elkins, not present. Representative Lynn.
Yes.
Representative Ramirez.
No.
Chair Seaton.
Yes.
4-1.
So we have moved HB 383 with individual recommendations from committee. We now have before us Senate Bill 86.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thanks for coming back. Hope you have a bill.
Oh, I wanted to say one thing. Could I say something?
Nope.
I just want to say I support the bill.
You can do it.
Right, that's right. Sorry.
Good morning. We have Senate Bill 86, CRA, effective date failed before us, and that was CS for Senate Bill 86. And appreciate it. I don't have your names on the paper, so would you go ahead and identify yourselves for the record and go ahead and tell us about the bill.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Craig Hillary. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Alaska Department of Law. With me is Ms. Randy Guerrero, Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. Thank you for agreeing to hear this this bill today. We very much appreciate getting in front of this committee. This bill deals with the liability of state and municipalities for attorney's fees. Since territorial days, Alaska has had a statutory policy of requiring a losing party in most civil cases to pay a portion of the prevailing party's attorney's fees. Soon after statehood, this policy was embodied in Civil Rule 82 by the Alaska Supreme Court pursuant to a legislative delegation.
And I just need to interrupt you for a minute. I didn't get your name down on the paper here.
I'm sorry, Craig Tillery.
Okay, Craig Tillery. And who else do we have?
Randy Ruaro.
Okay, go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, what SB 86 addresses the use of state and municipal funds to subsidize certain types of litigation through awards of attorney's fees to prevailing parties that are higher than the partial fees that are the norm in Alaska. The legislation would limit those enhanced awards to instances in which the legislature has made the policy judgment to provide for them by statute. Enhance the fee awards against state and municipal governments, which is the amount above normal compensation, represent a significant impact on the state treasury and on a more irregular basis on municipal funds. Ordinarily, the basis for these enhanced awards has been the judicially created public interest litigant policy, whereby selected litigants suing to advance ends deemed by the court to reflect strong public policies are granted full fees as a subsidy from the state treasury. For the state alone, over the last 10 or so years, this has averaged about $600,000 per year above normal compensation. SB 86 would address this by creating a new provision and a chapter of Title IX that is devoted to immunities. It relies on the legislature's constitutional authority to regulate suits against the state and to confer immunities on the state and municipalities, as well as the doctrine of sovereign immunity. It sets limits on liability that are similar and essentially identical to those limits found in Civil Rule 82 that courts have found for years to represent fair partial compensation to a prevailing party. The limits do not apply to condemnation proceedings, and that's because payment of full attorney's fees in a condemnation proceeding is a constitutional requirement, or in instances where the legislature has provided for the enhanced fee awards, for example, in fair business practices type cases. There is also an exception allowing courts to award enhanced attorney's fees as a sanction for misconduct by a party or by counsel. The immunity created by SB 86 is intended to do two things. One, it will save the state significant money each year, but most importantly, what it does is to reassert legislative control over state expenditures to encourage litigation on public concerns based on policy priorities that are determined by the legislature. This bill has been was introduced last year. It has come across from the Senate. There was also a companion House bill that has been is also in this committee. Since this time, there have been a number of cases that have come down of some relevance. Two of them that I would just like to invite your attention to. Recently, first of all, it was the ACLU case, and secondly, the Bochner case. And what these tend to demonstrate is the creeping nature of the court's award of attorney's fees against governments. essentially headed towards what appears to be full liability any time that the government would lose. Initially, public interest litigant awards wasn't an award. It was simply the public interest litigant doctrine came about as a shield to prevent public interest litigants from having to pay attorney's fees under Civil Rule 82. But later, the idea of the public interest litigant doctrine as a sword, where in fact they were entitled to enhanced fees, was put into the court's doctrine. Then later, the court expanded that to say, well, you not only get fees for the those items that you win, but if you win on anything, you get full fees for all of your work on the case and the dance rose. And then the court sort of expanded that to say, well, you don't actually have to win. If you bring the case and the state or the government reacts in such a way that suggests that you were the catalyst for that action, then you can get your full fees. And most recently, in this ACLU and in the Bochner case, there's been some concern because one of the factors that has actually been the most effective in limiting and in actually making any public interest litigant be able to make some sense was the fact that you had to show that there was not an independent sufficient economic incentive to bring the case. Recently, in the ACLU case, which dealt with benefits for state employees, the court was faced with the request that they be accorded public interest litigant status. There, the court stated that certainly the plaintiffs below contended that they were denied valuable benefits. We have implicitly recognized that the benefits to which they're entitled are economically valuable. Nonetheless, the court went on to find that was not a sufficient economic incentive for the reason that the plaintiffs might change their domestic status in the future before they actually got a benefit, or they might cease to work for the state. In essence, the court has said, if you can imagine a contingency by which you will not get this benefit, then you don't have a sufficient economic incentive. In effect, that means that public interest litigant status would be accorded in all prospective litigation against the state and municipalities. That concern was heightened for us shortly after that in a procurement case, where the losing bidder in a procurement sued and was accorded public interest litigant status. Again, on the assumption, well, maybe he'll get the bid next time if this is tossed out. So what these do...
Can you just explain that a little further? The procurement case was in basically challenging the procedures that were used to go through a bidding process but didn't actually change the award of the bid. Is that the rationale behind that or not?
It challenged a procurement. An actual procurement for an office building, and it tossed out the procurement and said you have to go back and rebid this.
Okay, so it was based on the court found faulty procedures that were followed by the state or municipality. So, but it didn't actually award a bid to. The
prevailing
party.
No, they have to go back and go through it. And by the way, I should note, that was a Superior Court case. That was not, the first one I mentioned was a Supreme Court decision, the ACLU case, but this was a Superior Court decision.
Okay.
But
and if you've supplied us a copy of the ACLU case?
Yes.
Just the order for attorney's fees.
In the ACLU case, we supplied the order for attorney's fees, and in the, I believe we supplied the Bochner decision, didn't we?
Was that through the chair? This is Grunberg. Was that appealed? Was Bochner appealed? You have the Fourth Judicial District Superior Court opinion.
Right.
Was that case appealed?
That will be appealed.
So it's not, it's on appeal at the time?
It will be appealed, yes.
Also, do you have a cite on the ACLU case?
And that was Representative Grunberg. Through the chair.
It is Supreme Court S10.
No, the Pacific.
Is that in the Pacific Court? I don't believe it's been reported yet. This is, well, if it has, it'd be very recent in there. This was a case that only came down
recently.
A few months ago on same-sex benefits.
Okay. Oh, you have the slip opinion number?
For the underlying case, I do not.
If you could get that to my office, Randy. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Or I'd like, or a copy of the opinion.
Excuse me for interrupting there. We're just trying to figure out where we are here. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I think actually I was there. Basically, the bill attempts to do two things. It attempts to control the fiscal impact on the state and municipality, and it attempts, I think, more importantly than that, to view the administration, that it would return to the legislature the right to set the policies as to when you're going to subsidize litigation. And that is something the legislature has done in the past, and it's done on several occasions. But if the view of the administration is that it's the legislature that should do that, not the court system.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. And I had a question based on what we did in the past here. Did we put an exception in so that if there was a constitutional challenge that would, if the basis of the challenge was based on constitutional grounds, then those fees would be awarded?
Mr. Chairman, you did in a bill four years ago, HB 145, you put in a specific provision that a party would be entitled to full fees in a constitutional case if they didn't have an independent economic incentive. And that is a bill to which this would be subject to. In other words, that would be an exception to this bill. The constitutionality of that bill, however, is currently in front of the Supreme Court.
It was struck down by the Superior Court, right?
Superior Court struck it down. The Supreme Court is considering it now.
Okay, so we have that, and I'm trying to. You have a copy of the legislative research report that.
I do.
Okay, and so we were talking about amounts of money, an average. One of the two largest ones there was in 2002, that $2 million, and that was basically challenging reapportionment under constitutional grounds. Mm-hmm. So those attorney fees, that $2 million for a 2002, is almost entirely made up of that. So I'm just trying to get a fiscal impact. So under the bill that we created before, those would still go forward. Those would still, if the Supreme Court upholds the action that we took in passing the bill allowing full attorney's fees if the challenge is on constitutional grounds, then that wouldn't be a difference under this bill, because have you done an analysis at all on the past of how many of these public interest litigant fees have been granted based on constitutional grounds, and therefore there wouldn't be a reduction?
Mr. Chairman, I have not. We could do that. It actually would involve going back and reading the decisions, because the other thing that the bill does is it deals with the dance rope problem by providing that you only get them on the actual claims that you raise that were on constitutional grounds. So that's what HB 145 did also. So, for example, if you were to have this an apportionment or whatever, and you raised four grounds, two of them constitutional, two of them statutory, and you only won on the constitutional ground, then you would only get your fees for that portion. So it would be pretty difficult to go back and do that.
Okay. Other than we can readily identify that year of 2002, in which almost all of it was based on the challenge by a political party to the redistricting based on a constitutional challenge, we can pretty well assume that most of that then would be or not, or would we have to go back and
Mr. Chairman, because I didn't do that case, I'm not familiar with it, but I believe that redistricting has some statutory elements to it. Mr. R, I don't.
It does. There are statutes on it.
There were statutory elements as well, so we wouldn't be able to figure that one out.
That was just Randy Ruwara.
Oh, yeah. And would you identify yourself on the record as well?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Randy Ruraro. I'm the legislative liaison for the Department of Law.
Legislative liaison?
Right.
That's okay. Correct. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I need to do something first. If you look at page 6 of 8, the attachment to the ledge research, the 96 subtotal case O'Callaghan v. Coghill, the open-close primary issue, that was my case, which I won, and those fees went to me. So I do have a conflict of interest, having from time to time taken these cases. And I guess I should ask to be excused from participating in this.
Objection.
Yeah. Thank you.
Objection.
That being said.
Would you tell us which one that was?
It's under FY96 subtotal under the name O'Callaghan v. Coghill. It's page 5 of 8. I didn't have my glasses on.
Just so we can note.
Yeah.
Page 5 of 8, O'Callaghan versus Coghill. Okay.
Yeah. Where we struck down the closed primary.
Was that on constitutional grounds?
Yeah, it was actually. Okay, and then subsequently, the U.S. Supreme Court in the California Democratic Party v. Jones reversed that. So. Okay. We don't have any more. Anyway, now you mentioned a, quote, Dansereau issue, Mr. Tillery. Give me the name of the case and the site on that, please.
Dansereau.
Is that D-A-N-S-E-R-E-A-U?
It's D-A-N-S-E-R-E-A-U v. Ulmer, 955 P. Second, 916.
955 P. Second, 915.
916.
916 B. Elmer. Okay. You mentioned that this bill does several things. First of all, both under the current law, if you win. If you lose, if you're a public interest litigant and you lose, they cannot award attorney's fees against you. You can't get an award of attorney's fees against you if you lose.
Under the Supreme Court doctrine, you cannot do that.
That's the current state of the law.
Well, actually, the legislature passed essentially abolished the public interest doctrine as the court had done through HB 145. That's, I guess, think until the Supreme Court rules on it, that is the current state of the law.
But it's now been ruled unconstitutional.
By a superior court.
Yeah. And secondly, if you win, you get full attorney's fees under the current state of the law.
That is correct.
And that's both at the trial court level and on appeal.
That is correct.
And that actually is not the case in other lawsuits. The case in other lawsuits in a declaratory judgment, which these are generally declaratory judgments and injunctions, although this would not only apply in that, it could apply if you claimed the state owed you money on a contract or the state injured you in a PI case. This would apply in any cases, right?
That is correct.
Okay. Normally,
Representative Grunberg.
But those generally where there's a money judgment are not public interest cases. They're just run-of-the-mill civil lawsuits.
That is correct.
Normally under Rule 82, if it's a non-money judgment, you get a percentage of your actual attorney's fees. Generally, as I recall, it's 20% if you don't go to trial, 30% if you do, if you win, I believe. In cases where money judgment's not.
20%.
Say again?
I believe it's 20%, but I don't have the rule.
Well, but it's a percentage.
It's a percentage.
Of your fees. And then on appeal, it's quite different. The Supreme Court, on an appeal, is under an appellate rule, not Rule 82. And the appellate rule gives total discretion to the Supreme Court. And they award very few attorney's fees to anybody in a non-public interest case. And it's generally somewhere between $500 and $1,000. And they, so it's almost a token, because it's a lot more expensive to take an appeal than that. And you get your cost, the printing of your briefs and stuff. They determine whether you win an appeal as an appellant. Generally, if you prevail on a single issue, they would hold you a prevailing party. They might not award you the full $1,000. You might only get half of it or something like that. But this would potentially, the...
Representative Grunberg, I understand, but the explanation, but I want to make sure we have questions for...
Well, I'm just making sure I'm understanding this right here.
Okay.
I'm looking at the bill on page 2, lines 22 to 24. In an appeal now, if you're a prevailing party, even against the state, in an injunction or a declaratory judgment action, you'd only get something of less than $1,000, which is far less than 20%. So this, I believe, Mr. Tillery, through the chair, might significantly increase the amount a prevailing party would get in a run-of-the-mill declaratory judgment appeal against the state. Let's say...
And Representative Grunberg, I think that's a good point, but what I'd like to do is, this is going to be something that you guys are going to have to research a little bit and look at numbers to be able to identify for us.
Let me explain here. Normally an appeal, let's
Representative
say
Grunberg.
A typical appeal might cost $8,000 or $10,000 in attorney's fees actual time. And if you have, let's say there's a mine and they've closed the road and you want an injunction to require the state to change their administrative decision so the road to the mine goes open, pay $10,000, you win on the appeal. Now you would only get $1,000 against the state, but you spent $10,000 in your appeal, successful appeal. Under this, you double the amount you'd get against the state. So it might, and which I would support, by the way, you might actually find prevailing appellants in non-money judgment cases getting a higher amount against the state than you do under the current appellate rule. Have you thought about that?
Mr. Chairman, this wouldn't affect that. This is only a cap. This sets a cap on what the state will pay. The Supreme Court presumably will continue in cases where it would have given $1,000, it will continue to give $1,000. What this would deal with was a situation where they might provide for full fees. So it doesn't require that you pay this amount of money. It simply sets a cap on the limit on the liability of the state municipalities.
So you're not through the chair. So you're specifically drafted this bill so it does not impact the current court rules. It's almost sort of a non-binding direction to the legislative appropriation process that the Treasury shall not be opened for more than X dollars. You're not intending to change the court rules here? I see nothing.
I think it's actually a binding direction. It basically finds as a matter of sovereign immunity that the state will not be liable for more than this amount. Then the amounts that it has in here, as I'm sure you've noted, mirror Civil Rule 82.
Except it doesn't mirror the appellate rule in the case I'm talking about.
Well, it applies it. The other part of the appellate, under Appellate Rule 508, is very loose.
Yes, 508.
And what this does is take the common court practice, which has been in public interest litigants to give full fees and other things to essentially the courts. And actually, I just was dealing with this on an issue the other day. Courts have been somewhat a little bit all over the board, but the normal practice is to, by analogy, apply Civil Rule 82 standards.
To the chair.
To administrative appeals.
Representative Grunberg.
Oh, now you're talking about...
And 508 applies to both of those.
So you're saying that in administrative appeals, they apply Rule 82... both at the Superior Court and the Supreme?
No. On the Supreme Court, they wouldn't. They would more typically give the $1,000, except in the case of a public interest litigant. This would simply set a cap on liability. It wouldn't change the court's normal practice. If the court would, we have no reason to think that the court would take its normal practice of giving, $1,000, and it would have changed that.
And Mr. Tillery, what I'm going to do is ask Representative Grunberg to get with the AGs and on these points that are really somewhat off the bill. I would like to ask a couple of things. One is that there's been kind of an understanding that someone could win on a little tiny point. They'd have many issues and not win on the main issue, but they could win on some technicality, and then the courts will award full attorney fees. And then, you know, we've been told by other people that under Alaska law, all litigants receive court awarded attorney fees only if they are the prevailing party, and litigants are considered the prevailing party if they succeed on the main issue. And it's Hillman versus Nationwide Mutual Fire Insurance. Is that correct in public interest litigants? So you have to win on the main issue, or is the argument that you can win on some small subsidiary issue and then you get full attorney fees as if you won the main issue? And is Hillman versus Nationwide not correct citation?
You do not have to, under Dansereau, you do not have to be the primary prevailing party. And essentially, Dansereau, the court awarded full fees even though the party won on only one of its three claims. A couple of other examples that might be of use to you. One of them is State versus Alaska Civil Liberties Union. It was a 1999 case where the 1996 campaign finance reform legislation was in front of the court. The Superior Court granted summary judgment to the Civil Liberties Union, ruling that all of the legislation's provisions were invalid. And because they were public interest litigants, they awarded them $99,000. That was appealed to the Alaska Supreme Court, which reversed virtually everything, holding that 9 of the 11 challenged provisions were in fact constitutional, remanding it to the lower court for determination on attorney's fees. The lower court came back and found that, well, you only won 2 out of 11, but we're going to give you $101,000 in attorney's fees. And interestingly, that went back up and was affirmed by the Supreme Court with the, interestingly, the dissenting judge was the one who had written the original substantive opinion in the case and who presumably knew it the best. Another one example is in the 1990 Cook Inlet area-wide lease sale, oil and gas lease sale. The Superior Court ruled that 85% of the lease tracts could go forward. The remaining tracts were simply remanded to DNR because they were important beluga whale habitat. The state challenged the full attorney's fees award, but in fact the court granted public interest litigant status, as it sort of should have under the law prevailing at that time, but then awarded full attorney's fees. So that's the way it works. It really is. It can be a very small portion, like in that one case, less than 20% of the provisions were actually struck down, but yet full attorney's fees.
Okay, thank you. And we'll take a look at those. Are there other questions at this time by the committee? Okay, thank you very much. Do we have, did you want to offer Randy Ruaro?
That's correct.
Okay, sorry, it's not written down on here, so I'm just trying to remember. Did you have any further comments that you would like to make at this time?
I don't, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I would like to say something on the record.
Well, we're in public testimony just first here. We have anybody online?
No, this is for Mr. Ruaro.
Oh, for Mr. Ruaro, yes. Representative Grunberg.
I would just like to congratulate your wife on her election to the board.
Oh, thank you. Through the chair, thank you very much.
Okay, we have online Scott Brandt Erickson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you. Would you identify yourself and who you're representing for the record, and go ahead with your testimony on, this is on Senate Bill 86 that you want to testify at this time, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Brandt Erickson. I'm the borough attorney in Ketchikan, My testimony today is my own. It's not representing the Ketchikan-Gateway Borough, and it's based upon my 18 years' experience representing municipalities in both giving advice and in litigation. I'm familiar with the committee substitute for Senate Bill 86. While in order to have my job be less frustrating at times, I might prefer that the bill also did away with the shield presented by the public interest litigant status. I think that the way the bill is laid out is a reasonable compromise, just doing away with the sword aspects. In my experience representing municipalities, I have had six or seven cases over the years that have involved public interest litigant issues. My favorite poster child for the worst case scenario involved a case in Anchorage that arose out of a recall election where there were organizations, they weren't really corporations, but groups of citizens who had opinions on the recall issue on two sides. One group sued the city clerk, claiming that she had erred in dealing with a recall petition. The court directed that she go ahead and certify the petition or take certain actions. And then another group sued on the other side, claiming that she had mishandled it. As the case processed through an appeal, we were sitting in the middle with public interest litigants on both sides, assured that we would lose to at least one of them and have to pay full attorney's fees with no prospect of getting our fees covered. While that's an unusual case, the situation of facing litigation over an issue which may be of minor importance to the entity, but a significant concern in terms of the financial risk to the community involved. It's a concern that I would like to see addressed, and I believe that this bill addresses it. In some of the comments that have been made, one of the things that I would mention, the public interest litigant attorney's fees is not a court rule as it is now, and so it doesn't require an amendment to a court rule to achieve the things that this bill is seeking to achieve. The changes in this bill, I don't believe, would create a sufficient disincentive to public interest litigants to keep them from challenging governmental actions which they believe were taken improperly. I think we'll see a comparable number of challenges in the future if this bill is adopted, but the stakes for those challenges for municipalities and for the state will not be as lopsided. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. In your, I don't want to talk specifically about Ketchikan, but it sounds like you've been a attorney that has represented other Title 29 entities as well. When things are being considered, when they're going forward, when regulations are being adopted, does this come into consideration as far as trying to make sure that you construct regulations in a way that are not going to be challenged? In other words, that they are properly constructed, because you know that if you have public interest litigants that can come forward and challenge the action, that they might be more likely if they can get their attorney fees?
Mr. Chairman, the There are occasionally issues where there is a you realize that there's a significant risk of litigation over the validity of the provision because there is a party that is either philosophically or economically motivated to challenge it. And the level of care, I mean, there's always a certain level of care, but the level of care you take to try and ensure that you have covered all possibilities to avoid successful litigation by someone challenging the legislation or regulation is probably higher in those instances. These public interest litigant cases, however, don't, only about half of the ones that I've had have come up in the context of political issues, regulatory type, or law changes. Half of the ones that I have encountered have arisen out of administrative discharge of statutory duties. For example, the municipal clerk being charged with processing recall petitions. There are specific duties that the clerk is charged with carrying out, and someone challenging how those duties were carried out isn't really challenging legislation so much as that the action was not taken consistent with what the rules are.
Okay, and so we've got about half of them that might be philosophical and making sure that administrative, and the other half are out of implementing the regulations that you have. Has there been any different or heightened awareness or heightened execution of those duties, knowing that that there could be public interest litigant challenges to those if those duties aren't executed in a very technically proper way?
Mr. Chairman, yes. In many of the instances where public interest litigation has arisen, and I'm excluding those where we believe that there was actually an economic motivation and the person just asserted they were a public interest litigant because they wanted to get the fee shifting. But in most of those instances where public interest litigation develops, it tends to be in areas where you know that there is controversy. In situations involving timber sales, situations involving highly charged political issues such as a recall or some sort of election contest, some of or if there's a very controversial piece of legislation, some of those areas you know that something's coming up, and you're doing your best. But the people who are not pleased with the way a particular policy issue was handled or the decision that has been made by the administrative official, they're going to look for anything they can find to try and get that decision reversed. And so regardless of how careful you are, it will not prevent them from going to court to try and get it overturned anyway.
Okay, thank you very much. Does anyone else appreciate your testimony today, and does anyone else have any questions? Representative Grunberg.
Yes, Mr. Brad Erickson. You said that this bill is designed to change certain court interpretations, and therefore you don't need to amend the court rule. We find that quite often what we're dealing with is a legislation designed to modify or reverse interpretations, say, of statutes. And the way the legislature works, if you're doing that, you amend the statute. And it's the same with the court rule. I don't see any difference. What basis do you have for saying that there's a difference between this particular piece of legislation and any other legislation where we're attempting to change a court interpretation.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, perhaps I misspoke or didn't speak as clearly as I might have. This legislation would change a court interpretation. However, that court interpretation has not been reduced to a rule in one of the court rules. The concept of public interest litigants and the way fees are awarded in public interest litigant cases is a construction of court decisions rather than a rule such as Rule 82. And so while this legislation would have an interaction with prior court decisions, it does not change the court rules themselves.
Okay, well, I think that's something we'd have to look at.
Representative Grunberg.
Because normally the attorney's fees provisions are interpretation of the court rules, and I just really have to look at that.
And we'll look at that for the next time we're a long in time. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on this bill? Thank you again, Mr. Brent Erickson, for your testimony.
I'm going to ask one other question.
Of Mr. Brent Erickson?
Yeah, yeah. There's been a longstanding, and I'm really kind of looking at Mr. Tillery, who's grimacing in the background there. There's been a longstanding question as to whether, if in fact this bill in some manner does amend these court rules, whether these particular court rules, Rule 82 and 508, require the two-thirds majority and the title amendment.
Wait a minute. Representative Grunberg, Mr. Scott Brown Erickson is testifying on his own behalf. He's not the AG here, so I want to make sure that we're asking him to testify in his area of expertise, yes. And we've got to hold this bill. Anyway, so if it's something for Mr. Brent Erickson,
this is
fine. Okay.
This is, please. Whether Mr. Brent Erickson, and then I'll also ask Mr. Tillery, whether you have an opinion on if we are modifying court rules here, these court rules, does it require a two-thirds vote or only a majority vote under the court's interpretive power? I don't need Mr. Tillery is moving to the front here.
Well, we'll hold that for our next hearing, and I'm going to rule that, if you want to ask, we can get that.
Mr. Brent Erickson?
No. If you want to get that, we'll get that from the legislature. But we're going to adjourn today. Thank you again for your testimony, and we'll, if Mr. Tillery, if you can prepare that, you could either submit that in writing, or we'll talk to you next time. But if you could submit an answer to that question in writing, that would be helpful to everyone. Thank you. We're adjourned.